Good afternoon, Dr. Daniel Guerra. This is Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is Friday, 16 February, 2024. We were talking about porosomes in relationship to fusion of membranes, particularly docking of extracellular matrices that involve a lipid component interacting with the outer leaflet of a plasma membrane. And then the insertion of that lipid component and perhaps an entire cellular mass into another cell. Now, that occurs frequently enough that we discussed it in general and in very specific cases when we were dealing with macrophages being taken up into the arterial system, particularly in cardiovascular disease. Right now, we're going to be more generic and we're going to talk and be conceptual because of that. And just talk about membrane fusion. And that's going to involve a great deal of discussion of proteins that are involved and then lipids. Okay. So that's where we're heading to this afternoon. Now, basically, the steps of membrane fusion. First, you get adhesion. Then you get what's called an opposed membrane approach system. And what that means is to get a lateral reorganization of the membrane components. For example, the fusion proteins that we've talked about, or any other potential binding proteins, they would have the right electrochemistry to be able to interact with either cationic or anionic lipids that would be associated with one or more of the membranes which are fusing. Okay. So that then will lead to the actual fusion event. The third event then is a destabilization of the membranes. And what happens there is there's a formation of a new system called an intermembrane intermediate. And that step is distinguished by lipid mixing of the outer monolayers of the membranes. Finally, the fusion process involves the communication of the internal, if there is a large internal, matrix or aqueous compartment. And then you get a mixing of those two compartments. This is after the membranes fuse. And what can occur then is leakage of some of those components. And that can include small molecules as well as proteins. Okay? So that's a really like brief architecture of what happens when we talk about steps in fusion. So let's now get into the detail of that. So we've already mentioned to you that mitochondria have multiple components in their membrane, the outer membrane and the inner membrane, which will allow for morphological transitions. And what can happen because of that morphological transition is a generation of what's known as a tubular network. And the tubular network is going to involve these different membrane components, the inner and outer membrane of the mitochondria, and then if there's a fusion to a second mitochondria. So you're going to have four total leaflets of membranes to deal with for there to be a fusion of one mitochondria to another. Okay. So there's a balance then between opposing interactions that regulate at the protein level and at the lipid level, the number of mitochondria that will take part in a fusion reaction. And so that means there's going to be a positioning of the mitochondria within the cytoplasm in association with the other organelles, which are all packed into the cell, so that those two mitochondria, which we'll just deal with a simple fusion, two distinct mitochondria, will fuse. And will fuse coherently so that now you will end up with one mitochondria because of that fusion. Now, that occurs because you're basically reducing the number of mitochondria in the cell. So the components that are in both mitochondria are now going to end up in one mitochondria. So there, well, while you get proliferation of mitochondria by fission, you also get fusion, which actually reduces the number. Now, subsequent to that fusion, many other things can happen, such as mitophagy, or even translocation of the mitochondria completely out of the cell. We talked about this before. So that whole process is very dynamic, and it's directly and coherently linked to the bioenergetics and stress response the cell is going through. Now, fission is characterized by the division of one mitochondria into two so-called daughter cellular mitochondrial components. So fusion is the union of two mitochondria making one. Fission is the production of two. Now, why would there be fission? Well, this is when the cell requires more mitochondria because there's more active oxidative metabolism. So you could appreciate this in something like a muscle cell, where the muscle is doing a great deal of work, such as contraction or relaxation. So mitochondria have to work overtime to generate enough ATP to carry out that muscle activity. So mitochondria then can go through fission to take accounting for the fact that more ATP has to be synthesized. So that's how mitochondria can replicate autonomously within the cell without the cell itself going through mitosis for a proliferative movement, you see? Now, interestingly, the peroxisome also can be duplicated by fission and can be reduced by fusion. And there is some indication that while mitochondria go through, their, say, will go through a fission reaction to duplicate, peroxisome follows suit, or this happens contemporaneously, because the peroxisome, again, is another subcellular organelle involved in oxidative metabolism. Oxidative metabolism including the synthesis and the degradation of oxygenated or peroxygenated fatty acids. And ultimately, hydrogen peroxide can be generated in the peroxisome. That's why it's called that. Okay, so the peroxisome and the mitochondria function together because they're dealing with different species of reactive oxygen, because the mitochondria can generate that by the one electron step reduction of molecular oxygen to H2O. And the peroxisome can deal with it as the peroxisome is degrading membrane lipids that have already been oxygenated and are ready to be removed because of the potential for a chain reaction, which can lead to the auto-oxidation of the plasma membrane and thus the complete corruption of the cell. So that's why the mitochondria and peroxisome have to carry out fission and fusion coupled to one another. So there's going to be an interaction between peroxisomes and mitochondria. But we're not talking about that right now. We're talking about the mitochondria as an isolated event. Okay. So there is a possibility during fusion or fission where you can have a dysregulation of the phenomena. And that is largely because of the lipid membrane components not being in the appropriate spatiotemporal enclave. So as I said, this is an event that's always happening in the cell. Now, when I say enclave, I mean particularly in geometrical association, physical geometrical association within the cell. So that's a spatiotemporal event. And if dysregulation occurs, what can happen as a result of that fission or fusion is fragmentation. And so what sometimes the cell can appear under microscopy is when you look for the subcellular organelles and you look at the mitochondria, you may find many very small, relatively round mitochondria. Those mitochondria are actually not fully functional. They are basically the degradation products of an inappropriate fission or fusion, one that became dysregulated. And what you get then, once you make those smaller, more oval-shaped mitochondria, they can start to fuse together inappropriately, form a mitochondrial network. And that network then is basically non-functional, or if it is functional, it's lost some of its capacity to carry on any further fission or fusion, and possibly it's lost some of its capacity to carry out what's going on in the mitochondria, such as electron transport, oxidative phosphorylation, amino acid metabolism, lipid metabolism, the expression of genes inside the mitochondria, etc. Okay? So you have a dynamic disequilibrium going on with mitochondrial replication and fusion. And see, some of these morphological intermediates can be linked to normal physiological or indeed more pathophysiological states, depending on whether or not you're catching the mitochondria in transition to fuse and make that fusion complete and in a way that is normally physiologically governed, so the mitochondria remains intact and functional. And so, likewise with fission, making two mitochondria out of one, or you may see that it's in a transition which is going to fail. So that's why it's a temporal response. You have to know that the result of that mitochondrial interaction may take a few minutes before the results actually occur. So if you're looking at cells that are isolated, frozen, and you're looking at different intermediates and different components of mitochondria, you have to remember that you're looking at changes as they occurred during over time, right? So it's not always easy to tell if the cell is ready to go through autophagy, or indeed if the mitochondria are really corrupted. You know that's going to be directly linked to programmed cell death through the canonical mitochondrial-based, caspase-based, cytochrome C-based apoptosis, okay? So in the G2M phase of the cell cycle, mitochondrial quality control, including mitochondrial DNA maintenance, has to be maintained. So often what might occur right before cell division is that mitochondria will not go through fission, but they will go through a reduction. They'll go through fusion. And that maintains the integrity of the mitochondrial genome. Because if the mitochondria rather started to go through fission when the cell was going through mitosis, there's always a potential for that process to lose mitochondrial DNA, whereas fusion is more likely to maintain at least one of the mitochondrial genome. Okay. And it still could cause an alteration of the matrix component of the mitochondria to be inherited or maintained as that fusion product, and therefore maintain oxidative phosphorylation, which is going to be necessary to finish the cellular division. Okay. So you see a lot of things like mitochondrial elongation occurring. And when you see elongation, that often is linked to processing towards autophagy. And one of the ways that that's been measured is by nutrient deprivation. Because autophagy, you can stimulate nutrient deprivation. What else can? Hypoxia. And we were talking about this last time. Now, let's go some detail here. Now, remember, it's all going to be about the phosphatase. In fact, as soon as I finish this brief protein detail, I'm going to finish this lecture going back to the phosphatidic acid phosphatase, because it's all going to be linked to this. So I'm going to bring that enzyme activity and phospholipid metabolism back very quickly. Okay, so let me talk about the proteins involved in the core machinery of mitochondrial replication and fusion. The core machinery involves those large GTPase proteins that are in the dynamin superfamily. Again, those are known as mechanoenzymes, and they can function by oligomerization, which then gives them a conformational change, and that drives membrane remodeling, which includes constriction of the membranes, scission of the membranes, or if it's going to fusion, ultimately the fusion that I just went through briefly. So mitochondrial constriction and scission are carried out by the dynamin-related like protein 1. Very first part of these lectures in the mosaic I told you about, DRP1s. And also another protein called dynamin 2, called DNM2. Okay, so mitochondrial fusion is ensured by the mitofusins 1 and 2. Remember, those are the MFN 1 and 2, and the optic atrophy 1 protein. And they respectively mediate the outer mitochondrial membrane and inner mitochondrial membrane fusion reactions. Okay. Now, if there are knockouts performed, of course, it's been done in the mouse model or in cells in culture. If you knock out either of those GTPases, okay, the MFNs or the OPA1, what happens? In mice, it's embryonic lethal. And embryonic fibroblasts derived from those mice are going to harbor major mitochondrial morphological defects. Okay. So that, I think, is a linear understanding of why that would be occurring. Because without mitochondrial ability to fuse or proliferate, the cell is not going to be able to maintain its integrity. Okay. So if this is happening in utero, you're going to get an embryo lethal out of that. Okay. So that's like the basic structure of what we're talking about here. We need to understand how those proteins are going to work at the mechanical level, but we have to reinsert our discussion of the phosphatidic acid phosphatase. I want to put that back in before we continue on with this fusion system. Now, I want you to remember where phosphatidic acid comes from. In glycerolipid biosynthesis, coming off of two intermediates from glycolysis, glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate and dihydroxyacetone phosphate. Dihydroxyacetone phosphate can be acylated to make 1-acyl DHAP. Glyceryl-3-phosphate can be converted after the acyl-CoA introduction to 1-acyl G3P. Both of those molecular species of glycerolipid can then be esterified to a second fatty acid to make phosphatidic acid, where in the SN1 and SN2 position of the glycerol backbone now has a fatty acid, and the third carbon position is going to have the phosphate. Okay. Now, at this point, you get the reaction phosphatidic acid phosphatase making diacylglycerol. So let's follow through that for a moment. Diacylglycerol can be used to synthesize many of the glycerol phospholipids. So starting with choline, and then choline is phosphorylated to choline phosphate, and then there's a CTP choline cyanotransferase making CDP choline. This is known as the nucleotide pathway. CDP choline and diacylglycerol will be used as a substrate to synthesize phosphatidylcholine. Okay. At the same time, And that diacylglycerol came from the product of phosphatic acid phosphatase. Same time, diacylglycerol can react with CDP ethanolamine, synthesizing phosphatidylethanolamine. But PE can also be synthesized from phosphatidyl serine via decarboxylase. So phosphatidylethanolamine synthesized either directly with CDP ethanolamine and diacylglycerol or by the decarboxylation of phosphatidylserine can also be used to generate phosphatidylcholine via the methyltransferase pathway. Okay? Now, the phosphatic acid can also be utilized directly in nucleotide phospholipid synthesis. Phosphatidic acid can be converted to CDP diacylglycerol. CDP diacylglycerol can be used to generate phosphatidyl inositols. And phosphatidylglycerol. And phosphatidylglycerol can be used to make diphosphatidylglycerol or cardiolipin, the main mitochondrial membrane glycerol lipid. Okay? Now, more detail about where this is occurring. Fatty acids first have to be esterified to coenzyme A. So from the, let's say, de novo fatty acid synthase coming directly off of the acyl carrier protein component of FAS in the cytoplasm, that fatty acid can be transferred to coenzyme A, the product of fatty acid synthesis, making acyl-CoA. Now that can occur either at the endoplasmic reticulum membrane or the outer membrane of the mitochondrion. So that acyl-CoA will now react with glycerol-3-phosphate, and that reaction, that acyl-transferase reaction, 1-acylglycerol-3-phosphate acyl-transferase, will occur either again on the endoplasmic outer membrane or on the mitochondrial outer membrane. The product of that is lysophosphatidic acid. Finally, then, the second acyl-CoA is added. Again, that can occur on the ER membrane or the mitochondrial outer membrane, generating phosphatidic acid. But the phosphatidic acid phosphatase is localized to the ER and not to the mitochondrial membrane. So at least not commonly. So the phosphatidic acid phosphatase will take phosphatidic acid and generate diacylglycerol. And this is happening at the ER membrane. And then you'll generate all of those products I just went through. Okay? So now you understand how that functions, hopefully, in the phospholipid pathway. Now let me see how much time I have left. There's more I can say here about the enzyme. Yeah, okay. So what about the phosphatidic acid phosphatase? Okay. Again, takes phosphatidic acid, generates diacylglycerol. That can also be used in the de novo synthesis of triacylglycerol. So DAG, diacylglycerol, is a substrate for TAG, which is storage lipid component, phosphatidylcholine, or indeed directly phosphatidylethanolamine. Okay, and I just went through those pathways with you. Now, there are two forms of the phosphatase. There is a cytosolic ER form dependent on magnesium, and it's inhibited by thiol reagents like N-ethylmalamide. The activity of that particular isoform is inactive until it's translocated to the endoplasmic reticulum membrane. And that has to occur in the presence of acyl-CoAs. And indeed, the phosphatidic acid itself. Okay? This is mobilizing the enzyme. Now, phosphatidic acid and acyl-CoAs will help mobilize the enzyme to the ER. Okay, that's what we're telling you. Now, the substrate, of course, is phosphatidic acid, and it's localized on the ER. So that's where this enzyme is going to function at its highest activity, because most of the phosphatic acid you find in the cells in the ER membrane. Now, the second phosphatidic acid phosphatase, the other isoform that's been isolated, is not inhibited by thiol agents like N-ethylmalleimide, nor is it stimulated by magnesium. So that phosphatase has been examined to some detail, and it is a glycosylated protein that is found on the plasma membrane. And it actually possesses six transmembrane domains. So that phosphatidic acid phosphatase, known as the lipid matrix phosphatase, won't just hydrolyze PA, it will also hydrolyze ceramide 1 phosphate, sphingosine 1 phosphate, and lysophosphatidic acid. Okay? So that's a lipid-based enzyme. You understand now what this is doing. The active site of that enzyme is predicted to be on the face extending to the outside of the cell. And the phosphatase activity that it possesses doesn't appear to have any role in intracellular phospholipid metabolism. So it's involved in signaling. Okay? Now I bring that up because this is authentic biochemistry. Now, there's more to the phosphatidic acid phosphatase. That's just beginning stages, okay? It's the beginning stages of this discussion. We're going to get into much more detail about the enzyme, about its kinetic constants, as well as quite a thorough discussion of its physiological consequence in mitochondrial fission and fusion. Okay, well, but just right now, I wanted to make sure we start talking about the phosphatase itself because, well, that's the title of this mosaic, right? Okay, so the intermitochondrial membrane fusion is going to occur subsequent to the outer mitochondrial membrane fusion. And you know that it's mediated by the OPA1. And that is a very specific GTP dynamine protein you only find in the inner mitochondrial membrane. And there are specific lipids necessary for that protein to sequester in the IMM. Okay? And we'll get all into all of that later. Right now, I'm going to tell you that if OPA-A is lost during fusion, and therefore you're generating mitochondrial fragments, what will happen is mitochondrial elongation, and that can lead directly to mitophagy. Okay? So that's an important thing to consider. The OPA-A is necessary for a complete resolution of fusion for the inner mitochondrial membrane. If OPA-A is missing or somehow isn't in the right concentration or in the right place in the inner mitochondrial membrane because of alteration of lipid components, which is also detected, then rather than getting fusion, you're going to get mitophagy. Okay? So that's one of the fates that can happen during the fusion reaction. I'm going to leave you with that because, it's time. So hopefully this lecture gave you a little bit more of an understanding of what the distinction is between fission and fusion. And also, I think, a decent introduction into the enzyme we really want to lock in on before we're finished with these mosaic lectures, Mosaic 1, which is all about ultimately, a phosphatidic acid phosphatase plays a role in mitochondrial fate and therefore cell fate. This is Dr. Daniel Guerra on the 16th of February, 2024, wishing you a pleasant Friday evening and bye for now.